Okay, folks, we're pretty close to kickoff time. So, are there any questions before we start? I was going to start with this, Sammy. Okay, so here's what I thought I'd do. Today I posted my sixth viral update, and basically, you know, reflects all the things I've been doing on the first five, where I reflect what markets did last week, which is a relatively quiet week, relatively. And I also look at the equity market damage across regions, across sectors, across industries, across different classes. But this week I added something that is near and dear to what I like to do, which is I look at the price of risk. And by now you know what I mean by the price of risk. It's bond default spread in the bond market and the equity risk premium, the implied equity risk premium. So I computed the, so in this post, if you get a chance, I would like you to read it. I look at the implied equity risk premium by day from February 14th through April 3rd. And I'm going to try to keep updating it on a daily basis, at least for the next couple of weeks, and I hope to end it soon because I don't want to keep doing it for the rest of my life. But if you look at the daily implied equity risk premiums, they've been climbing, obviously, as the market has dropped, and they peaked around March 23rd at around 7.75% if you leave the cash flows fixed. I'll tell you what the basic problem, the implied premium approach is. You're updating the S&P 500, you're updating the T-bond rate, but the cash flows are pretty stale because people are not updating them as frequently. So if you bring in those updates, and I'm just a moment, sorry. Sorry about that. If you bring in those updates and you do a, what I call a COVID ERP, I thought long and hard about giving it that name. You know, my implied equity risk premiums have risen, and at the end of last week, they dropped back to about 6.15%. In fact, on April 1st of 2020, my implied equity risk premium for the S&P 500 was 6.01%. And I said, it's time to go back and revisit my equity risk premiums for other countries. And here's why. The equity risk premiums for other countries start with the US premium, and we build on top of that, right? And how do we build on top of that? We get the default spreads for countries, which I'd done on January 1st. And I wasn't planning to revisit till July 1st. But this has changed that. So I went in and redid the default spreads. And guess what the sovereign default spreads have done over the last 6 weeks? They've jumped as well. So what you're seeing in the red numbers here, and I would send you, you can go to the, you can either go read the blog, and it's in that blog, and you can download the entire updated country risk premiums, or I'll send you links to it. The red numbers are my updated premiums by country as of April 1st, 2020. The green numbers is what they were January 1st, 2020. And to anybody who says, what difference can 3 months make? Take a look at the differences on those numbers. The US, the premium obviously has gone up from 5.2 to 6.01%. But if you take markets that are risky markets, like Lebanon, for instance, the premium went from 14% to 24%. This is one of the problem. This is one of the unfair aspects of a crisis. You have a crisis, the developed markets are the place where the crisis is evolving, but guess where the pain is felt most? It's in emerging markets. So starting today, I'm using these updated premiums. I did a kind of, you know, semi-update in that spreadsheet that I sent you. I'm going to update it to April 1st, 2020 numbers all the way through. So don't worry about redoing your DCF for the moment because it's like a shifting target, you know. So I think that, you know, Benjamin points out that Lebanon just poses an economic crisis. The ratings also have shifted for some of these countries. So this is a true update. It's not just the US premium. The ratings have been updated. The default spreads have been updated. So these are the numbers I will put into the spreadsheets today. And so if you download the FCFF Ginzu starting tomorrow, you should see the updated numbers. Are there any questions on the equity risk premium numbers? Because in a sense, this is something we've talked about over and over during this class, and it's a neat little tool to at least get some perspective during a crisis. Incidentally, in that post, I also compare what happened between this in these 6 weeks to what happened in the 12 weeks of the in the last 12 weeks of 2008. So you see the day-to-day computations. It's very interesting because you can compare, you know, you can compare across across the two crises, to see what they have in common, because that crisis, the implied equity risk premium peaked, I think on November 20th of 2008 at 7.83%, very close to the 7.75%. I'm not saying our peak is behind us, because that'd be too hubristic, but I think it's interesting to set the graphs next to each other. Any questions? Now, in fact, since I'm on this on these slides, I'm going to go show you how the premium, so you can see what the numbers look like on a daily basis. Let me show you the numbers. That's what 2008 looked like. The implied equity risk premium by day, starting 2012, 2008 to the end of 2008. There's the peak, 7.83%, November 20th of 2008. Here's what the last 6 weeks have looked like. There's the unadjusted peak, 7.75% on March 23rd. This is the COVID-adjusted equity risk. You're saying, what's a COVID-adjusted? I think that the earnings and the cash flows are definitely going to change. The analysts have just not got around to making the changes yet because they feel too uncertain. So the COVID-adjusted numbers, I knocked down the earnings for the S&P 500 and the cash flows. So it'll give you a more subdued equity risk premium because the price of risk is not jumping as much as you think it is. It's jumping. So that's what the gray line captures. Any questions? Okay, so I'm going to put these slides
away. I'm sorry, why the COVID-adjusted risk premium is lower?
Yeah, because if your cash flows decrease, remember the equity risk premium is an internal rate of return. If I leave the cash flows high and I knock down just the index, I get a much higher expected return. Because two things are happening in the crisis, right? The price of risk is going up, but the cash flows are also coming down. That's why when your cash flows decrease, your equity risk premium effect is more muted.
Right.
Question. If we compare this to the bonds graph, where you were comparing and seeing that this is where you can, when the bonds to the ERP mm-hmm. ratio goes below one,
there's a bond market graph. Which rate? Because when you talk about bond market graph, you have to pick a default spread, right? Each rating class has its own default spread. This is actually the default spread by day for the different bond ratings. So you're going to pick the investment grade rating. The investment grade rating, I think the spread was about, let's see where it is. It's probably the yellow line. The spread was about 4%. So the US, the equity risk premium is about 1.5 times that spread. Now, you can download the raw data. It's actually fascinating to look at these different markets. I know fascinating is a terrible word to use when things are dark and you're in a crisis. You know what? But you got to keep learning what you can. So you download the raw data and take a look on a day-to-day basis at how these different prices of risk are moving. Because it's going to give you some insight, both into what's already happened and perhaps into what's coming. Okay, so no questions. I'm going to go back and finish packet one because we're running a little behind. I want to make sure that we finish packet one today and get at least started on packet two. So remember in the last session, when we ended the session, I talked about intangibles and why I was going to capitalize R&D and how it might affect value. So I'm going to take you back to, I think, 2009 or 2010. I valued Amgen. And Amgen, of course, is a pharmaceutical company with significant R&D expenses. I took a 10-year amortizable life. For those of you who had to capitalize R&D for your companies, you know it's a subjective judgment. The reason I use 10 years for pharmaceutical companies, it takes a really long time for R&D to become a commercial product because of the FDA approval process. So I collected the R&D expenses for the last 10 years. So this is pretty much standard, what we did earlier. So what I ended up with was a capitalized value for R&D, the unamortized portion of $13.3 billion, and an amortization of 1.694 billion. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to show you what Amgen's numbers would have looked like without the R&D adjustment, and then show you what the numbers will look like with the R&D adjustment. And let's see how this might change our valuation of Amgen. Let's start with net income. If I believe the accountants, Amgen had net income of 4.2 billion, but if I capitalize R&D, I'm going to add back the R&D expense. Why? Because it's an capital expense, not an operating expense, and subtract out the depreciation, the amortization, 1,694. I would report higher net income. So that's good, right? Amgen will have higher net income. My book equity, which was 17.9 billion, according to the accountants, I'm now going to add the capitalized R&D and my book equity jumps to 31.1 billion. If I compute the return equity, according to the accounting numbers, the return equity was 23.5%. But if I capitalize R&D, that number drops to 17.8%. Still really good, but not as good as I thought it was with the accounting numbers. Operating income, same jump as in after both pre-tax and after-tax, same jump in the because of the R&D. My book value of invested capital increases by the 13.3 billion. So both book equity and book capital increase by the capitalized R&D. And my return capital, which I thought was 25.4%, now drops to 19.7%. So you can see lots of moving pieces here, right? Your income goes up, your invested capital goes up, your return capital goes down. Say, what does this all mean? I valued Amgen with R&D capitalized. You know what I mean by R&D capitalized? My numbers now reflect the capitalized R&D. I use the adjusted operating income. I use a reinvestment that includes R&D. In other words, everything I do is now driven by my view of R&D as a capital expense. I'll cut to the chase. With those numbers, here's what I get. I get a return on capital of 16.7% for Amgen and a reinvestment rate that's very high, partly because I'm capitalizing R&D. So when I did my projections, I incorporated that in my valuation. A high reinvestment rate, a return capital of about 16%. The value per share that I got was $74. Now, if you played with my spreadsheets, the R&D is just a tab, right? You can say yes, then capitalize the R&D, adjust all the numbers. So it does this for you in the background. If you say no, I revert back to the accounting treatment of R&D as an operating expense. So I finished my valuation. The value is $74. The stock was trading at 55. And I was going to buy the stock, but I said, I wonder what will happen if instead of capitalizing R&D, I went back and treated it as an operating expense. So that's all I'm changing in this valuation. Is I'm changing the yes to the no. And for those of you who capitalize R&D, try this out on your company. Because here's what happened in Amgen. When I did not capitalize R&D, in other words, I went back to the accounting treatment, my value went from 74 down to $43. You see what's happening? If I capitalize R&D, Amgen looks cheap, but if I don't capitalize R&D, it looks expensive. Now you say, well, that's what's always gonna happen when you capitalize R&D. That's not true. In fact, at the same time that I valued Amgen, I also valued Merck, another big pharmaceutical company, 10-year life. When I capitalized R&D, I got a value about 25% lower than what I got when I did. So in other words, I got the exact opposite effect at Merck. Capitalizing R&D lowered my value at Merck, but it increased my value at Amgen. How would you explain the difference in effects between the two companies? Because if you can tell me that, you'd see why we capitalize R&D. Why in the case of Amgen does capitalizing R&D help the company? But in the case of Merck, capitalizing R&D in 2009 hurt the company.
Return on capital is higher than cost of capital?
On what? Not the overall return on capital. The return on capital on R&D is higher than the cost of capital. You know what we do when we capitalize R&D? We treat it like any other asset. And if you're investing in R&D efficiently, you know what I mean by efficiently, you invest in R&D and your revenues and earnings go up, your products come through the pipeline, capitalizing R&D will increase your value. That's what happened at Amgen. In the 10 years leading into my Merck valuation, Merck had spent $100 billion, on R&D, and its earnings had stayed flat. What does that tell you? They're spending a lot of money in R&D, but it's a terrible investment. It's earning a terrible return. If we don't capitalize R&D, we're giving companies that do R&D a free pass. And I don't think we should do that. R&D, there's nothing glorious about R&D for the sake of R&D. If you're a commercial entity, you do R&D because you want to generate higher earnings in the future. What capitalizing R&D allows us to do is to separate the companies that do good R&D from the ones that do bad R&D. And in 2009, Amgen was still on the good side and Merck had fallen to the bad side. In fact, pharmaceutical companies collectively have found R&D to become less and less effective over the last 20 years. I have a blog post from a while back that if I can find, I will send to you, where the return on capital in R&D has dropped well below the cost of capital at the older pharmaceutical companies. And you know how they how they've adjusted, right? So over the last few years, what's happened is they've cut back on R&D, and what they're doing instead is acquiring young biotech companies, young pharma companies for what's in the pipeline. I'm not sure that's a great strategy either, but it's a reflection of where they are in the life cycle. Any questions about the capitalization? So you could do the same thing for a consulting firm with human capital, with an oil company, with exploration costs, and what it's going to allow you to do is see if in fact R&D is value creating or value destroying in your company.
Professor, isn't this going to be very sensitive to the amortization period so that you could?
Yeah, it is going to be sensitive, not so much to the amortization period, but to the trend during the amortization period. Because if you think about how my earnings is adjusted, I add the R&D expense back and I subtract out the amortization. If you have flat R&D expenses for the last 10 years, in other words, your R&D has been roughly the same for the last 10 years, your R&D expense and your amortization are going to offset each other. Your earnings are not going to go up much. So some of that comes from the fact that if you're a growing pharma company, you're more likely to be helped by R&D than if you're a mature. So more than the amortizable life is what your R&D expenses are doing over the life. And let me show you the Amgen trend. It started at $663 million, ended at $3.03 billion. So growing company during the period. Merck, it was much flatter because they were at a stage in the life cycle where they were mature. But amortizable life does matter because if your amortizable life is only 2 years, amortizing R&D is going to have very little effect on your value. If it's 5 or 10 years, it's going to have a much bigger effect, but it's not a choice that you usually have, right? If you're a tech company, your amortizable life is probably 2 or 3 years. You're not going to get a 10-year life. If you're a pharmaceutical company, it's very difficult to have an amortizable life less than 7 or 8 years because the approval process itself takes so long.
Professor, could you use a different ROIC, let's say if their R&D going forward is more looking more promising than what their R&D has been in the past?
You could do that with every asset, right? It's not just R&D. So if you're thinking companies change, of course. What you're asking is a much more fundamental question. Are you stuck using last year's return on investment capital for every asset? Absolutely not. But you better have a really good story as to why it's changed, right? Otherwise, you're just going to sit there and say, let me make 8 into 15. So if you're making an 8% ROIC into a 15% ROIC, I'm going to put you on the spot and say, tell me what's changed. And if you have a really good reason and a really good story, okay. I'm on board. But I think that's the essence of valuation, is you get to make that judgment, but that judgment has to be based on facts and a story. You can't just double the return on investment capital just because you feel like it.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
I'll tell you though, one thing to keep in mind here, one reason pharmaceutical companies are having a tougher time generating value from R&D is 30 years ago, pharmaceutical companies had complete pricing power on drugs. You know what I mean by that? Basically, they'd come up with a drug and they'd price it to cover their R&D costs and then price it even more to earn a premium. And there was no pushback on the other side. Today, who's the largest buyer of drugs in the United States? Who's the largest customer of your pharmaceutical company?
Medicare.
Sorry, what? Medicare. You basically are, Medicare is your biggest buyer. And your insurance companies have not consolidated. So instead of facing 50 health insurance companies, you're facing 3. The game has become a much more even game. Your pricing power has not gone away, but it's decreased substantially. And that's starting to show up in the return on invested capital. There's always a fundamental reason why these numbers shift. And it's good to isolate what that reason is, because that reason is going to continue in the future. Guess what? There is no recovering here for a Merck or a Pfizer where things are going to go back to the glory days. It might actually only get worse as you go forward because your pricing power is going to get even more muted. Any other questions?
Can we adjust the R&D expense for like the probability of success or something like that?
Because in a sense, you're not asking, that's what your earnings do, right? In a sense, return on invested capital is not where you do that. Basically, the return on invested capital just looks at what you've spent in R&D and what's shown up in earnings so far. That's why allowing those returns on capital to change over time, you're implicitly making assumptions about probabilities of success in the future. So let the changes in ROIC try to capture the probability, because if you try to explicitly estimate that probability, you go crazy. Because what if you have 50 drugs?
Got it. Thank you.
So let's now talk about the last part of the dark side. I want to talk about valuing cyclical and commodity companies. I don't know how many of you are valuing oil companies this semester, but if you are, my sympathies. It's going to be a really tough time to be valuing oil companies, even if they're large, mature companies. And here's why: when you value an oil company or a cyclical company, things get messy. Think of those four questions again. What are your cash flows from existing assets? What's the value created by growth or destroyed by growth? How risky are you? When will you become a mature company? Imagine asking these questions for an oil company. When I ask you, what are your cash flows from existing assets? If it's 2011 and oil prices are $100 a barrel, your answer is, we have lots of great cash flows. When I ask you, what's the value of growth? You say, it's amazing, or everything's paying off big time. When I ask you, how risky are you? You don't feel very risky. Lots of cash flows. You can cover your debt easily. And when I ask you, when will you be a mature company? You look out way into the future. So because oil prices are 100, the answers to all four of those questions was sanguine. You're pretty good about it. Let's say it's, you don't even have to bring to 2020. 2020 is a nightmare scenario, but let's say you're at 2016. Oil prices are down to $45 a barrel. I ask you the same question, same company. And I ask you, what are your cash flows? They're much lower than they used to be because oil prices have dropped. And I ask you, what's your value of growth? You might discover that a lot of investments you took 2 or 3 or 5 years earlier when oil prices are 100 have become bad investments. Good value creating has become value destroyed. When I ask you, how risky are you, especially if you're an oil company with debt, all of a sudden you see a lot more risk than you did than when oil prices were 100. And ask you, when will you be a mature company, especially if you have a lot of debt, that becomes questionable whether you make it back to being a mature company. And if you think about doing this today, even for a company like Royal Dutch or ExxonMobil, you're going to see a dramatic drop off in all of the fundamentals. See what I'm trying to say? Every question with a commodity company, there's a macro variable hanging out in the room affecting how that question is answered. In this case, oil prices. And with cyclical companies, it's how the economy is doing. You could be the best cyclical company in the world, but if the economy is in a recession and a deep one at that, your earnings are going to be terrible. You're probably going to lose money. All your projects are going to look awful. Your return on capital is in the toilet. You're going to be look and feel very risky, and you might not make it as a mature company. So whether we like it or not, when we value oil companies or cyclical companies, we're going to be tempted to forecast out that macro variable. You know what I'm talking about? You sit down to value an oil company today, you feel this urge, let me forecast out what oil prices will be in the future. I'm going to beg you not to do that for a very simple reason. Let's assume, what are oil prices today? $25 a barrel, somewhere around there? Let's say you sit down to value an oil company and you bring a point of view about oil prices into your valuation. You say, look, I think oil prices over the next 3 years are going to go to $60 a barrel. And you were trying to value Royal Dutch. My advice to you is, why are you wasting your time valuing the company? I know exactly what you're going to find. If you think oil prices are going to go from $25 per barrel to $60 a barrel, you're going to find Royal Dutch and ExxonMobil and Conoco and Occidental and Chevron and every oil company in the world to be cheap. You say, so what? Well, if you're that good at forecasting oil prices, what the heck are you doing valuing ExxonMobil or Royal Dutch? There's a much easier way for you to make money, right? What's that easier way? If you can really forecast that oil prices are going to go to $60 a barrel, rather than value ExxonMobil or Royal Dutch, what should you do? Yeah, go buy oil futures. If you're that good at forecasting macro variables, don't waste your time valuing companies. You have a golden pathway to make money, take advantage of it. So one of the things I push for is what I call macro neutral valuations. You're going to see me try this out on Royal Dutch in 2016, but I'm going to have to use some nifty techniques to make it macro neutral, because it's not just the point of not making an explicit assumption, because sometimes you make implicit assumptions in the numbers you use. The second thing to factor in here is when you value an oil company, you realize you're at the mercy of oil prices. You feel helpless. You value a company at $22 a barrel or $25 a barrel. By the end of the week, your valuation might be defunct because the price went to 10 or went to 35. So one of the things I'm going to talk about, and I'm going to draw on a technique I used on Amazon a couple of sessions ago, is to use simulations to allow you to capture the uncertainty you feel about the macro variable. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take an oil company and I'm going to first do a macro neutral valuation of that company. And I'm going to go through some of the techniques I use and why I use those techniques. And then I'm going to bring in a Monte Carlo simulation to capture the fact that I'm really uncertain about where oil prices are going. So here was my Royal Dutch valuation in March of 2016. Before I show you this valuation, I'm going to show you a graph. This is on the next page. What I did was I graphed out Royal Dutch revenues against the average oil price each year. So starting in 1989, all the way through 2015. So the brown line is the average oil price. The blue columns are the revenues of Royal Dutch. Do you think the two move together? I think it sure looks like they do, right? I didn't trust the graph. I said, let me bring out my statistics book. I computed an R squared, and guess what I found is the R squared, 96%. Royal Dutch is almost a pure oil price play. I mean, somebody once, when I was valuing Royal Dutch in 2016, somebody asked me, who's the CEO of Royal Dutch? And my answer was, I don't know, and I don't care. You see why? What's the CEO going to do? Come in and watch the oil price move on a minute-to-minute basis? And I also did something, and you're going to see why in a minute this is going to be useful. I ran a regression, remember the tool in your toolkit and statistics, of revenues at Royal Dutch against the average oil price. You see, what's that going to allow me to do? You give me the oil price right now, and I'll tell you what revenues Royal Dutch will have. And given the R squared, I'm going to be pretty close to the actual number. So let me go back to the previous page, because I was trying to value Royal Dutch in March of 2016, and the oil price had dropped to $40 a barrel from $55 in the previous year. Now, usually when you value companies, what do you start with? You start with the trailing 12-month numbers, right? Initially, I started with the trailing 12-month numbers for Royal Dutch, and I realized I was going to have a problem. You know what the problem was? What's the problem with using trailing 12-month numbers for Royal Dutch in 2016 if oil prices have gone from $55 during those 12 months to $40? During those trailing 12 months, oil prices were $55, right? And with $55, I'm going to get much higher revenues, much higher earnings. So in other words, if I just take the trailing 12 months for any oil company and oil prices have dropped since those trailing 12 months, I'm automatically setting up to overvalue the company. So those of you valuing Conoco or Chevron or ExxonMobil, your trailing 12-month data reflects a very different world. The average oil price last year was between $50 and $55 a barrel, maybe even higher. The oil price today is $25 a barrel. Use your trailing 12 months. I'll save you the trouble. You're going to look really good on a valuation perspective. So here's the first thing I needed to do. I needed to restate those numbers to reflect the lower oil price. Now do you see why the regression helps? All I did was I took the regressions. Remember that regression I ran on the next page? I took the regression and plugged in a $40 oil price. That gave me revenues of $201.6 billion. That was about $15 billion lower than their actual revenues. You're saying, that's unfair to Royal Dutch. No, it's actually very fair. That $215 billion reflects a $55 oil price. I'm going to put in a $40 oil price. I'm going to come in with revenues that better reflect the current price. Then I worked it through. I got lower earnings and lower cash flows as a consequence, but I valued Royal Dutch using those base earnings and allowing oil prices to increase at the inflation rate every year. I'm being market neutral. I could even use futures prices. Futures prices are perfectly okay. But remember, future prices for oil are not expected prices. They're just current prices adjusted for storage costs and interest rates, because you can always store the commodity. It's a storable commodity. It's not true for wheat or corn or something that's not storable, but oil, futures prices don't tell you anything about expected prices. They just reflect current price adjusted for interest rates and storage. So I valued Royal Dutch with the $40 stock oil price, and I came up with $39.31. Much of what I've learned in valuation, I've learned the hard way. You know why I did this for Royal Dutch? Because 3 years earlier, I made one of the worst mistakes, investing mistakes of my life. And I bought Vale, a Brazilian iron ore mining company. It was 2013. I called it my triple C bet. A bet on country, bet on a commodity, bet on a currency, because Vale had all three going in spades. And I bought it because iron ore prices had dropped in the previous 2 years, and I thought they'd hit bottom. And I said, okay, I'm going to make a bet on Vale, and they would ride the iron ore price back up. So I took their trailing 12 months. I assumed the trailing 12 months reflected the iron ore price during those 12 months. And I valued the company at about $14 per share. The stock was trading, more than that, $19 per share. The stock was trading at the $14 per share I bought Vale. Year later, the stock was at $5. Obviously, I bet wrong. But I took a look at what I messed up, and it turned out that when I assumed that Vale's financials reflected the current iron ore price, I made a mistake. It turns out that because they hedged so much of their production, it took 2 years before the lower prices actually showed up in the numbers. And I said, never again. When I value a commodity company, will I just trust the trailing 12-month numbers? I'm going to check the price. I'm going to check to see whether the price has changed. And I'm going to do what I did with Royal Dutch the best I can. Not every oil company is going to lend itself as well as Royal Dutch to this kind of adjustment. But it's a good adjustment or a good graph to look at for your company to get a sense of how sensitive it is to that macro variable that concerns you. Any questions on the Royal Dutch valuation and what I was doing there? Samir?
What was the price per share during that valuation, do you remember?
It was at the time that I did this valuation?
Yeah.
It was 43.
Okay.
So it came in close to fairly valued, no.
Okay, thank you.
Professor, the base year and the first year forecast, actually the first year forecast is higher. Shouldn't that have been lower?
Because my base year is already adjusted for the 40. If I'd left it at the trailing 12 months, so what you see as my base year is an adjusted value. It's not the trailing 12-month numbers.
Oh, I see. Okay.
If I'd used the trailing 12-month numbers, there would have been a drop in year one. And that's the advantage of adjusting your base year is you don't have to do what you normally do, which is drop year one, and which is what many of you would be doing with your oil companies, right? Year one is going to be terrible. We're going to write it down and then bring it back up. This year, I just adjusted the base year.
So base year meaning last 12 months, it's already adjusted for the
lower. Yeah, base year just means the numbers from which I'm forecasting. So it's not a trailing 12-month number.
Oh, okay. So have you done the similar regression for like oil drillers versus oil price?
Or? I'll tell you what you can do it if the oil drillers are correlated. The R-squareds, the younger and more evolving an oil company is, the lower the R-squared is going to be because there are other things they do that affect revenues. See, this works really well for an ExxonMobil, a Royal Dutch, a British Petroleum, you know, an Aramco, but it doesn't work as well if I, or even a Conoco or a Chevron, but if I go to a small oil company or an oil driller, it'll be much more difficult for me to link, but the revenue should still be affected by the oil price. So you might want to see what that link is. If nothing else, you might find some oil service companies are actually not that affected by the oil price. You know what? That's good news because those companies are being punished because oil prices are lower now. They're good investments to you because they should not be punished. So this is a way in which you can separate. So what I would suggest if you have with Capital IQ, you can download the year-by-year numbers for different oil companies, large and small. You can download the oil price. Just do a simple correlation. What you're looking for are oil companies which have low correlations with oil prices and have seen their stock price get knocked down 50, 60, 70%. Mm. Yeah.
So did you assume a $40 price per barrel on a go-forward basis?
No, basically I used futures prices. So the $40 was my starting point. But remember that your futures price, in a sense, it's going to be very close to the base price, though, because it's going to be like 1%, 2% higher because just the futures price is just the interest rate net of the storage costs. And interest rates are low and storage costs for oil are relatively low. So that's what I use for my future.
Right.
But how do you, the market numbers, those are not, you know, somebody's forecast.
How do you account when projecting revenue, the change in future oil prices?
I don't want to. Okay. That's precisely the reason, because if I bring in a view about future oil prices changing, then that is driving my valuation, not what I think about the company. Here's what I think. When you ask me to value an oil company, you want me to value the oil company, not tell you what my views are on oil prices. Because if you want my view on oil prices, you should ask for it separately. So I'm not saying you shouldn't have a view on oil prices, but I'm saying that view should be separated from your valuation of the company. And you should offer me both things. You should say, look, this is my oil price neutral valuation of Royal Dutch. Oh, by the way, I think oil prices are more likely to go up than down. That might affect my allocation decision, right? Whether I invest in oil companies in the first place. But your valuation of Royal Dutch will then tell me whether I should buy Royal Dutch or ExxonMobil or British Petroleum or Lukoil as my stock in my portfolio. So you value companies because you want to take a position. You take a position on a macro resource because it affects your asset allocation.
Also regarding the operating margin, it jumped significantly post current 3.01. So
part of that was they had some unusual expenses. So that is a company specific issue, which is there in years in which, you know, when they have, because oil companies sometimes have special costs and they're writing off past oil investments. So some of that was just a cleaning up. That 9.35%, if you look across that entire time period, is kind of a convergence margin across all oil prices and seemed to be relatively insensitive to what the actual oil price was. That might not be true for other oil companies. It might be that at lower oil prices, you have much lower margins as well. No, but Royal Dutch, at least, I didn't see that connection.
Okay. Professor, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, so we've been looking at, in the case of a commodity company, but what about with like more cyclical companies, say like a tractor manufacturer or something like that, where it's not tied to a particular commodity? How would you go about
in a cyclical company, what's your macro variable that drives it? Economic growth, right? So if you think the economy is going to boom, you have a much greater growth rate. There again, you don't want to bring a point of view about when the next recession will be. You basically have to build in whatever the current expectations are into the analysis. So the cyclical companies are much more open to normalizing. You know what I mean by normalizing, right? Look across a cycle and say, across the cycle, my margins are typically 11%. Right now, I'm in a recession. My margins are only 3%, but I'm going to value the company on the assumption that margins would revert back to a steady state. And it cuts both ways. If I'm in a boom, I'll bring the margins down. So that target margin becomes the margin you think the cyclical company will earn over the cycle. So cyclical companies, I think, are less problematic than commodity companies because the swings are not as wide.
Okay.
Professor, so this adjusting the base, would you recommend that for all service companies as well, even though the R-square might not be?
Yeah. In general, it's good to think about it, at least for every company. For some companies, it's going to be very difficult to do. And you're going to say, look, I'm not going to try to do it. I'm going to start with the trailing 12-month numbers and use your one to do my adjustment. For instance, for airlines, how the heck do you adjust for the fact that nobody can get on a plane right now, right? It's going to be impossible to do. So you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to make 2020 my vehicle for everything that worries me about airlines. You're going to see revenues drop and our earnings become huge losses. So it's easier said than done for some companies, but I always think about it when I look at a company. Is there some way I can adjust my base numbers? Because it does make my valuation easier.
And the other thing is, besides revenue, everything else also changes, like operating margin, CapEx, when
so you'd have to oil think, price. So in a sense, you're going to see me deal with two numbers that aren't, the two numbers that worry me with Royal Dutch is one, what will happen to the oil price? The second is, did I get the 9.35% target margin draw? And so those are the two things that worry me. And I'm going to talk about what I'm going to do to try to bring in my concerns about them. But you do have to think about those other numbers. And you know what drives the margin is your fixed cost and your variable cost. We have an oil company with very high fixed costs and oil prices drop to $35 a barrel. You might be looking at negative margins in perpetuity, right? Because you can't even cover that cost. So I think that with some of the shale oil companies, you could look at the numbers with the current oil price and your stomach drop saying there's no good ending here that I can forecast for value. You're basically buying an option with these companies, an option that oil prices will go up.
But in the base year as well, you would make the adjustment, I presume, right?
Yeah. Your base year is your chance to kind of fix things that you think are off kilter. So revenues might be changed, your margins might be different. So in a sense, you know, make the changes in your base year, then it allows you to build off that base year. It's called normal. It's a normalizing vehicle.
Okay. Yeah, thank you.
Can you use this model for also valuing companies which are like independent of economic variables, macro, but like dependent on
the technique is a general one, right? If you can tie, for instance, you're a user-based company and you think that your revenues are a function of some particular variable, how many people buy a particular product, iPhones. Let's say you sell something that is linked to iPhones. You might then R-squared or relationship between your revenues and the number of iPhones sold. So it's a general technique you can use to adjust for almost any variable from outside that's driving your company.
But what about variables which cannot be predicted? Say, for example, companies in India which are dependent on rainfall, like seed manufacturers which are dependent on seasonal rainfall.
Forecast. Rainfall is very forecastable. It's just you get forecasts with there, just like oil prices. I mean, you have, 2,000 years of rainfall results. It's not like, you know, the part of India where you get only 15 inches is going to get 500 inches. I mean, you have a long history. Weather, in fact, has the longest data set. We just don't use it very well. Okay. Right? I think what this is a harnessing of data. We now have the data. We couldn't have done this 30 years ago. It would be very difficult to do. We now have the data on pretty much any macro variable. And we can start linking up the company's operations to that macro variable. So here's what I did.
Just one more theoretical question. Sure. As an output of this model, wouldn't it be more useful instead of outputting a price per share, why not output a price per share as a multiple of the price of oil? I assume that would work as well, right?
You could, in which case you could actually, in fact, I'll give you a much richer way of doing this, right? Now, what are the two variables that I'm concerned about? One is oil prices and the other is the operating margin. You know what I did? I created a Monte Carlo simulation around those two variables. And then I ran the simulation pretty much, I think, 100,000 times. So there's a distribution of value. My median value for Royal Dutch is about 37, very close to my base case because my base case assumptions match up to the middle of the distribution that I used. But you can also get a distribution of values, and you could actually also then, as part of the output from the Monte Carlo simulation, create a link between oil price and value. In other words, you tell me the oil price, I can go to the distribution and say, this is what your value should be. A much richer answer to what you were suggesting by looking at value, because that's a static estimate and it might not be linear, right? So if the oil price doubles, your value might not double. And that's a problem with any multiple. This allows you to look at it in a much richer way.
Gotcha, thank you.
Okay. Sammy?
Yeah, just one quick question. In this case, you gave an example in oil prices, going to non-diversified economies, the Gulf, for example, some countries are dependent on, governments are dependent on oil, and therefore the economies are dependent on oil.
You get a double whammy. Yeah, absolutely. So in a sense, even consumer product companies in the Middle East are oil. So you could do this with any consumer product company. In fact, you could take any company in the Middle East, and my guess is there's a link to oil somewhere.
Okay, so in this case, I can put that in.
Yeah, absolutely. Retail companies in Saudi Arabia, I'm sure, are hurting right now. Why? Because oil price is $22 a barrel.
It's basically not the oil price as much as COVID now, but yeah.
And Dashan raises a very good question, a very good point, which is for much of this data, we look backwards and we're talking about weather and how we have a lot of history on weather. Dashan's point is global warming is creating chaos in forecasts. It doesn't mean you can't forecast variables. This means there's a lot more noise. So I think that's something to factor into the macro variables as well, as things are getting less predictable. You can't make it go away just by ignoring them. We're just facing up to it. So when I do simulations, I think of myself as facing up to uncertainty, and it's a healthy process. Any final questions? Because we've wrapped up intrinsic value and we're going to start on pricing. Any questions on? Okay. So here's what I'm going to do as a prelude to the second packet. I'm going to set up the discussion. Remember this graph from the very first class where I said value comes from cash flows, growth, and risk, and use intrinsic valuation to estimate it? That's what we've been doing through 17 sessions of this class. We're now going to switch gears and talk about price. What's price driven by? Demand and supply. What's demand and supply driven by? Cardinalinos, market mood, momentum, what I call incremental stories. And the way you estimate a price is by looking at other companies, other assets just like yours, and attaching a number to your asset. So the value process, cash flows, growth, and risk deliver a value. The pricing process with mood and momentum delivers a price. And the big question in investing, and all of active investing, is there a gap? And will it close? And what will cause it to close? I'm going to argue that everything in investing is somewhere in this picture. To set the process up, let me give you a very simple illustration of what I mean by pricing. Now, 2 years ago, we moved from, my family and I, actually just my wife and I, because my kids are now grown up out of the house, moved from New Jersey to California. And we made the unfortunate decision to move to the most expensive part, the most expensive state in the country, and we picked a part of California called La Jolla. It's part of San Diego. And this is the house we initially looked at. It must have been a hut. Because why? Because there are only six numbers in the price. So let's take this house. It's a Redfin, I think it's a Redfin listing or a Zillow listing. There's a price for the house. And there's this nice lady, Lisa Padilla, who's the realtor. So let me ask you a question. How did Ms. Padilla come up with that $995,000 as the price for the house? Did she do a discounted cash flow valuation? I don't think so. Very simple, right? What did she do? She looked at other houses in the neighborhood. She looked at what people paid for them. She adjusted for the fact that this is a smaller house with a smaller backyard. And presto, she had a price. Real estate is all pricing all the time. That's not just true for residential. It's true across the board. So when you look at real estate, it's pricing. You're saying those unsophisticated realtors, they need to take some finance classes. Have you ever looked at an equity research report? If you look at an equity research report, this is an equity research report for a company I've never heard of, BB Biotech. It has a buy on it. I've covered up the name of the analyst and the name of the company to prevent embarrassment. You know what the buy was based on? The fact that BB Biotech was trading at a lower multiple of revenues than 15 other companies that this analyst claimed were exactly like BB Biotech. Let me ask you a question. Who do you think was on more solid ground? The realtor who attached a price to a house based on six other houses in the neighborhood that had sold recently, or this analyst who claims to have found 15 companies just like this company? I think the realtor is. You know what? 90% of what passes for valuation out there is really pricing. Because when you see pricing in equities, it's very sloppy pricing. I take the realtor's pricing over an equity research analyst pricing. So before we go into pricing and talking about doing it well, let's think about the drivers of value and the drivers of price. We know what drives value. Remember these four questions we asked every time we're on the dark side. What are your cash flows? What's the value of growth? How risky are you? When will you become a mature firm? That's what drives value. So for value to change, one or more of these variables have to change. Remember the it proposition. You see, what drives price? Here's what drives price. First is mood and momentum. You say, what do you mean, mood and momentum? All you need to do on any given day, especially in this crisis, is sit and watch the market move. You'll see it move for no reason at all. 5% up, 3% down. What's driving it? People try to attach rational explanations. The reality is nobody really knows. The mood shifted. The second is what I call incremental information. Information that you look at and say, that's a pretty trivial piece of information, but the price will move by 10% because of it. The pricing process, small pieces of news can cause big price changes. Why? Because there's a lot of group there. People look at that price, let's say collectively, and they move as a group. There's a herd mentality that drives pricing. Everybody seems to shift at the same time. And that's exaggerated now by the advent of computerized trading and big hedge funds moving in the same direction. And finally, when you talk about pricing, you got to bring in liquidity. Right? If you have illiquid markets, the price might not move as much, but when it moves, it can move substantially. So mood and momentum, incremental information, group thing, and liquidity. So let's think about it. The value process, cash flows, growth, and risk, the pricing process, driven by different determinants. The question I said was, think about the gap. There are three views you can take about the gap. The first is what gap? What do you mean what gap? If you believe in efficient markets, you know what you know, if you go back and look at that page on price and value, if you believe in efficient markets, what are you saying? You're not saying price is equal to value every single time, but you're saying the price is pretty much the best estimate you have for the value. So in your perspective, if you're a believer in efficient markets, there's really no gap. Or if there's a gap, it's completely random. You don't know which direction it's going to be. So if that's what you believe about the gap, you know what you should do? You should finish the class, obviously, because you want the credit. But after you finish the class, stop valuing companies. Just put your money in index funds and move on. So if you truly believe that there's no gap, some of you, as you've been valuing your companies, I notice you getting drawn to this perspective because I've had quite a few emails saying, I valued my company, but there's something wrong. And when I push back and say, what's wrong? I'm getting a value different from the price. Come on, guys. If the end game is to make the value equal to the price, why go through these contortions to get there? But that's the reality if you believe in efficient markets. If you're a value extremist, you say, who's a value extremist? All you have to do is go to Omaha every year. This year, I think they've canceled it to that, you know, Woodstock for value for investors. Yeah. These are what I call value extremists. They believe value matters and that price is driven by shallow people. That's how they believe trade. That's what they characterize traders to be. And their view is there's a truth out there. The value will always converge to the price and we're going to win. So the very righteous about this, they believe that if they buy and hold these cheap stocks, that the value will, the price will eventually converge on value and you will end up making money. I don't believe that's true, but that's what value extremists believe. They believe that they're right and the price will move to them. The pricing extremists are the traders. You know? So if you think about Fast Money, the 5 o'clock show on CNBC, and you've got five traders talking about the market, none of them talk about cash flows, growth and risk. It's about mood and momentum. They believe that the people who value companies are eggheads who really have no idea what they're doing, and there's no such thing as value. So what they're looking for are pricing differences. So your value extremists, your pricing extremists. I think I'd put myself somewhere in the middle here. I believe in value, but I'm not an extremist. I don't believe that I'm due a return just because I bought something undervalued. But with each of these views, there are weaknesses, right? So if you're a pricer, in other words, you're a trader, here are your three basic weaknesses. The first is you have no anchor. If you don't know what I'm talking about, go back and read my third viral post where I said, when you're pricing things, there's no floor and no ceiling. You know what I mean by no floor and no ceiling? You're pricing Bitcoin, and Bitcoin can only be priced. So the price rises to 16, 18, 20. You say, what's too high a price? And they say, I have no idea. There's no upper bound. And there's no lower bound. You can keep pricing it down, but there's no floor. In fact, the floor is zero. You can't go below zero. So with prices, there's no anchor, nothing that says, hey, it can't go beyond this number. It's too high or too low. You really have nothing to anchor it to. Second, the nature of pricing is you're reactive. Why? Because you're trying to gauge what the crowd is doing and get ahead of the crowd. And because you're trying to do that, your problems multiply because crowds are fickle. They do strange things. They're very tough to get a read on. So if you ask me, what will the market do tomorrow? My answer is, I have no idea, especially it's a pricing market like this one. It could go up, it could go down. It'll be driven by a small piece of information, but that's the prices doing. They say, that's why I'm not a trader. Well, if you're a valuer, you have your own dilemmas, right? The first is, when you value a company, don't tell me you're certain about the value because that suggests hubris. You have to be uncertain about your value because you made assumptions to get there. So you're uncertain about how, you tell me there's a gap, but you're uncertain about how big the gap is because you could be wrong on value. You know what else you're uncertain about? Even if you get the gap right, to make money, the price has to move towards the value. The gap has to close. You're uncertain about what will cause the gap to close and whether you can make it close. Now, it's true. If you lengthen your time horizon, you increase your odds, but you don't make them 100%. And you're looking for a catalyst that will cause the gap to close. So when people talk about being value investors, I say it's great. Well, no, the skill set you need is you need to be able to value companies. You need faith in that value because that value could change. But you also need to think about what will cause the gap to close. And one perspective we can take is what I call the karmic approach, where you say, look, it'll happen. I don't control it. So I'm just going to buy undervalued companies and hope the gap closes. Which if it makes you comfortable and you're okay with it, go ahead and use it. The other is you look for a catalyst in the company, something that will cause the gap to close. Like what? Like a Carl Icahn showing up. Now, basically, you're buying the company. Say, please, God, let Bill Ackman or Carl Icahn take a position in the stock, because there's nothing else that's going to cause it. The other is a pretty morbid exercise. We look for something else that might cause the gap to close. I'll give you an example. Let's say I'm screening for cheap stocks. I look for low PE ratios and a high return equity, and then I throw in a screen. I throw in the age of the CEO. You see, what's that going to do? You know what? One of the things that causes markets to take a new look at a company, which is what a catalyst is, right? Basically, a new look at a company, is a passing of the guard from an old CEO to a new CEO. I know this is a morbid exercise, but if your CEO is 84 years old, you know what? There's change coming. So think about catalysts. It's not just enough to find undervalued companies. You need to increase your chances of success by looking for catalysts. Now, Jose asked, don't increase your chances to almost 100% if you have a diversified portfolio? I wish. That's not, no. And that's where the faith comes in. You have a lot more faith than I do, Jose. My chances are nowhere near 100%. If I can improve them to 60%, let's say, forget 60%, 55%, I'm way ahead of the game. If I beat 50%, I'm way ahead of the game. You know, the average active portfolio manager wins about 45% of the time. So don't look for 100%. It's not going to happen. So as a final example of this, you know, before we close the session, I've been valuing Apple every year since 2011 on my blog. I've been valuing it since 1980 something, but I haven't kept those. I should have. Really. So what you have in this graph is my estimate of value per share in September. So basically every September through September of 2019, there's my value per share and the price per share. Let's start in September of 2011. The price was $54 per share. I had to do the split adjustment, but it's about 54 on a split adjusted basis. Stock was trading at 69. It was undervalued. I owned Apple then. I felt pretty good. September of 2012, the stock price had jumped to 95. My value was 91. And actually, I sold Apple for the first time in September of 2012. I wrote a long post because it tore me apart to sell a company I love so much. September 2013, I revalued the stock. The value was up 86.43. The stock had dropped to 68. I bought it again. You kind of get where I'm going, right? If you look at Apple over these 10 years, I valued it, or these 9 years that I'm showing, I valued it 9 times. The price has been set each year. Investing is not just a game of your value chain, because people get uncomfortable when they look at the value changing. The price is changing as well. And what you're looking for is that difference, because you're trying to take advantage of the difference. I've bought Apple 5 times in the last 10 years. I've sold Apple 5 times in the last 10 years. Kind of tells you, you know, where I am with Apple. But what I'm trying to tell you is when you value a company at the end of the semester and you make a judgment on your company, let's say you find your company to be slightly overvalued, but you love the company, don't lose hope. Right? Because it was slightly overvalued May of 2020, revisited in December of 2020 and May of 2021. Did I lose you for a moment there? I think I'm okay, Sammy. I didn't see the little sign that came in. Yeah, okay. So basically don't give up, because you value, it could be overvalued today, it could be undervalued in the future. So I think that it is something that, you know, that's why there are stocks I revisit over and over again. I've been valuing Tesla every year for 7 years. It took me 6 years of valuation before I finally bought it. So don't be patient. Find the 30 or 40 companies that you really like and revalue them and value them. And if you really like them, one of these days, you know, they'll be in your portfolio. That's what I said about Tesla in 2017. Nobody believed me. 2019, I bought it. It's now out. I want it back, but I want it back at the right price. So I'm going to end this packet with a picture from one of my favorite movies. You know what movie this is, right? It's America's most beloved movie, The Wizard of Oz. For those of you who've never seen the movie, I'll tell you the story. And if you don't like the story, don't blame me. I didn't write the story. It's called Dorothy, lives in Kansas. She's sucked up by a tornado and dropped into Oz, and she lands on top of a witch. and kills the witch. I don't know, but I always get these mixed up. Wicked Witch of the East, West, you know, one of the witches gets killed. And poor Dorothy's facing homicide charges, and she wants to get back home to Kansas. The movie starts with this catastrophic event of Dorothy landing on a witch, killing her, and saying, I want to get back to Kansas. And she has this munchkin on the side of the road. Well, how do I get to Kansas? And the munchkin says, I don't know. You got to go see the Wizard of Oz. He has the answer to every question. And she says, how do I find the Wizard of Oz? And the munchkin says, follow the yellow brick road. And the rest of the movie for 3 hours, you follow Dorothy down the yellow brick road. She dances, she hops. She never walks. If you ever see the movie, she's never walking. She's skipping, she's jumping, she's hopping, she's running. And along the way, she collects a motley crew of a lion that wants courage, a tin man that needs. And so basically, each of them needs something. And they're all told, go see the Wizard of Oz. He has the answer. So 3 hours later, they finally make it to the wizard's chambers. The wizard is covered with this curtain. And each of them tells the wizard, oh, we've come a long way. Dorothy says, I'd like to go to Kansas. The lion says, I want a heart. And the wizard says, come back tomorrow. It's like a government office. So they said, but we've come a long way and we really need the answers. And that time the curtain falls and they discover there's no wizard. There's a guy, a small guy standing there with pulling rods. But it turns out that each of them got what they wanted on the journey. See these red shoes that Dorothy has? She found them somewhere in the journey and she clicks the red shoes, she's back in Kansas. Why she wants to go back to Kansas, I don't know, but she's back in Kansas. The lion fought off some bad guys during the movie and that gave him a heart. You see, what's this got to do with valuation? Valuation, people think there is an equivalent of a Wizard of Oz. You might call it Google search, which is when you have a question, what do? You go ask Google search. Oh, great Google search, what tax rate do I use? And it says effective tax rate, gives you 16 references. Okay? That's nobody out there has the answers. You know how you find the answers to the questions in valuation? On the journey. So the valuations you're doing is where you're learning valuation. It's not what you're preparing for the quiz. And guess what? The process doesn't end on May 11th of 2020. That's the last day of class. This is the beginning of a process. Keep working on the basics. And along the way, you'll find a way to be able to answer pretty much every question that you come up with in valuation. So rent the movie, have plenty of time on your hands and watch it. So I'm going to start there, and since we have a little time, I'm going to start on the second packet. Now I'm pushing it, but no, let me at least get started. So if you don't have the second packet, don't worry. Today we'll get through only a few pages, but when you get a chance, do it. So in the second packet, I'm going to spend time on pricing. So let me again go back and review very quickly what's different about pricing. When you're asked to price an asset, here's what you do. You find other assets, comparable assets, similar assets, and you assess what other people are paying for those assets, and then you try to decide how much you pay for yours. Think SeatGeek or StubHub. You're trying to buy a ticket to a game. Of course, there are no games right now, but to a Yankee game in, let's say, August or September. The way you decide how much space, you look to see what other people are asking for seats in that section, and you attach a price to whatever seat you want to buy. That's pricing. So to do pricing is a three-step process. First, you need to find similar assets out there. Easy with SeatGeek, because you know, baseball seats, if you have a section, they're pretty similar, but much more difficult with stocks and companies, similar companies. Second, you cannot compare market values across companies. You know why? If I just use the market price per share as my assessment of expensive or cheap, what's the most expensive stock in the US? Just looking at the price. It's Berkshire Hathaway, right? It's like thousands, it's $250,000. And the cheapest stock is a penny stock, but that's absurd. That's why we divide the price by something. We standardize the price. A multiple is just a standardized price. We divide by earnings per share, by book value, by sales. So we standardize prices. So we find comparable companies, we standardize the price, and then we compare those standardized prices. And we're careful, we control for differences. Why? Because higher growth companies maybe should trade at a higher standardized price. Higher risk companies maybe at a lower one. It's a three-step process. So I'm going to start with a statement and try to back it up. much of what passes for valuation out there is pricing. You know what I mean? Out there, so when you see a banking valuation of a company, it's a lie. It's really a pricing. When you see an equity research valuation of a company, it's a pricing. In fact, let me back this up. About 20 years ago, I collected about 550 equity research reports from around the globe. I make a confession. I didn't read most of them. I collected them because I wanted to look at how equity research analysts put a number on a company. Out of the 550 equity research reports, 45 were discounted cash flow valuations, less than 10%. Most of the rest, almost every single one of the rest, used a multiple and comparables. They were pricing after pricing. The name of the game in equity research is pricing, not valuation. And it makes sense because in an equity research analyst, that's what you've got to do. Colin? Oh, your mic is
sorry.
That's okay. Yeah. So I said, maybe it's different in corporate finance. So I was able to get my hands on about 100 acquisition valuations. That's really tough to do, actually, because bankers hide their M&A valuations so that nobody can ever look at them because they want to see how unrealistic their forecasts were. So I looked at the 100 acquisition valuations. Then it seemed almost 50-50. About half looked like discounted cash flow valuations. Keyword is looked. Let me ask you a question. When you do a discounted cash flow valuation of a company, what's your biggest single cash flow? Terminal value, right? And in most of these acquisition valuations, the terminal value is estimated using a multiple. EBITDA multiple, revenue multiple. It was a pricing in disguise. So much of what's out there is pricing, and that left me a little puzzled and a little surprised. And here's why. At the end of every one of my valuation classes, I do an exit question, right? Right after you finished your project. Remember, on your project, you have to do a DCF. You also have to do a pricing of your company. So the end of the semester, and I'm going to ask you the same question when you leave this class. I'm going to ask you, given your experiences with intrinsic valuation and pricing, which one do you trust more as an investor? And I try to keep my biases out. It's not about me. It's about what you've. And every semester I've asked this question, the breakdown has been about 70, 20, 10. You're saying, what are you talking about? 70% of the people leaving my class say they're believers in intrinsic value, probably reflecting my biases. 20% say they like the pricing more. It's much simpler, fewer assumptions, and 10% become believers in efficient markets. You know what? Sometimes having to value a company makes you realize that markets are doing a pretty tough job. So 7-2, though, the people who choose pick intrinsic valuation over pricing. I haven't done a follow-up interview, but I wager if I track these people 5 years later at their jobs as equity research analysts, bankers, consultants, CFOs, I'll wager that the numbers get reversed. Something seems to happen between the time people leave my classroom, believers in intrinsic value, and what happens in the desks that they take their jobs at, which leads them from being believers in value to users of pricing. So I started thinking, well, what is it about the world out there that makes these believers in value into people who use pricing all the time? And I came up with three answers, and you're welcome to add to the list. The first, I think, reflects a reality which we're often unwilling to face, which is a lot of valuation is selling. You know what I mean by selling? You don't do valuations as an abstract exercise. You use a valuation because you're trying to sell something. Sell something to your clients, your boss, your colleagues. And it's far easier to sell a pricing than it is to sell an intrinsic value. Yeah. And in fact, the answer came to me while I was watching a Seinfeld episode. You've seen Seinfeld, right? Quintessential New York sitcom. And watching the episode, during the episode, one of Jerry's girlfriends accuses him of being crazy. She says, Jerry, you're crazy. And he says, if you think I'm crazy, you should see the guy who lives across the hall from me. You know who he was talking about, right? Who lives across the hall from Jerry Seinfeld? Kramer. And relative to Kramer, who's crazy, right? Think of, if you've never seen the Seinfeld, this will make no sense to you, but watch a Seinfeld episode. Kramer is beyond the realm of crazy. You see, what's this got to do with pricing value? Let's say your job is to sell me a company. All you have to do, if you're doing pricing, is to show me more expensive things, right? Say, look, 10 times revenues. You might think it's high, but look at these 20 other companies. They traded 50 times revenues. Yeah? So when you look at at pricing, you have to remember that a lot of pricing is driven by the fact that people are trying to sell things. It's not bad, it's not good, it's their job. And pricing, it's easier to sell a pricing than to sell a valuation. Second, when you do a valuation, your insides are out there for everybody to pick apart, right? So when you do valuation, people are like, why is your cost of capital so high? Why is your growth rate so high? Why are your earnings so low? They can pick you apart. Instead, if I told you that I like this company because it trades at 6x EBITDA, because that's what other companies in the sector trade at. Think of how small your target is. You don't like 6x EBITDA, you know what I tell you? Take it up with the market. It's not my fault. I'm just the conveyor of the news. In pricing, you're basically passing the buck. It becomes easier to defend the pricing. And finally, here's a reality check. You're never going to be 100% right with any approach. I'm a believer in intrinsic value, but I think if I'm right 55% of the time, I'm way ahead of the game. I think with pricing, I might be right 51% of the time, hopefully little more than 50%. But here's the catch. While I'm right more often with intrinsic value, when I'm wrong, I'm far more likely to be wrong alone. Do you see why? With intrinsic value, far more likely to be wrong alone. Because with intrinsic value, you're more likely to be buying things when everybody else is selling. You're more likely to be a contrarian. So when you make a mistake, you're far more likely to make that mistake alone. You think, so what? You know what happens to people who make mistakes alone in business? They get fired. If you make a mistake, the rule is make sure you have lots of company. With pricing, you will always have lots of company. So all those airline analysts who told you to buy airlines in September, you know what their defense is? We were all doing it. Don't pick on me. So when you think about why pricing is out there, it's there to stay. And here's how it plays out. I think even if you're a true believer in intrinsic value, you need to understand pricing because your job might require you to price things. If you're a portfolio manager and you run an equity mutual fund, you have to play the pricing game. Most portfolio managers have no choice but to play the pricing game. If you're an equity research analyst and I'm giving you 15 companies to follow, you can't tell me to sell all 15. I'm asking you to play a pricing game. And ultimately, you will get judged, even if you're an intrinsic value player, against other portfolio managers who are playing the pricing game. So here's the way I think about it. When somebody asks me, do you want to price something or do you want to value something? My response is, why are you making me pick? Why can't I do both? I think that even if your valuation is right, it makes sense to understand the pricing process. So this is one of the big differences in how this class is framed. 30 years ago, when I first started teaching valuation, I used to try to talk people out of pricing things. I no longer do that, because I understand your work might require to price things. And I think it's a useful skill to have. I price almost every company I value because I'd like my company to be both undervalued and underpriced. I have two things working in my favor. If I make money, nobody comes to me and says, did you make money because it was undervalued? Or do you make money, it was underpriced? I made money, that's the thing that matters. So what I'm going to kind of end the session with is at least a sense of what you need to do pricing, which is you need to standardize the price. So think about what you need for a standardized price multiple. You need a numerator and you need a denominator. What do you have in the numerator? You need a market set number. It can be the market value of equity, market capitalization. It can be market value of equity plus market value of debt. And I'm even going to let you cheat and use book value of debt instead. That's market value of the firm. Or it can be market value of equity plus market value of debt minus cash. That's called enterprise value. And there again, I'm going to let you cheat and use book value of debt. But the numerator is a market value number. It's in the denominator that you get the real play, right? You can divide your market value by revenues if you have revenues. And if you don't have revenues, you can even divide it by things you think might give you revenues in the future. Number of users, number of downloads, number of subscribers, number of website visitors. You can divide market value by earnings. It can be either to equity investors, net income or earnings per share, or to all investors, operating income. You can divide by cash flow. For equity, that can be net income plus depreciation if you want a shortcut, or if you want to do it right, maybe free cash flow equity. Or to the firm, which can be operating income plus depreciation amortization, EBITDA, or if you want to do it right again, free cash flow to the firm. We can divide by book value of equity, book value of equity plus book value of debt, which is book value of the firm, or book value of equity plus book value of debt minus cash. If that looks familiar, that's your invested capital from your ROIC calculation. So numerator is always market value, denominator is a scaling variable. So I'm going to set up what we're going to be doing for the next few sessions. With every multiple, I go through a four-step process. I start by defining the multiple. Okay? You're saying, I know what a PE ratio is. Do you? When you talk about PE and I talk about PE, are we talking about the same PE? So I'm going to start by defining the multiple and passing it through a consistency test. And I'll talk about the consistency test and whether it's being uniformly estimated. Then I'm going to describe the multiple. Sounds fancy, right? I'm just going to use the data. I'm sick and tired of rules of thumb with pricing. You know what rules of thumb I'm talking about? If a PE ratio is less than 10, a stock is cheap. An EV/EBITDA less than 6, a company is cheap. Price to book less than 1. Who makes up this crap? And why do we have rules of thumb when we have the data? So I'm going to do some basic data assessment, and that's what I mean by describe the multiple. Along the way, we're going to see some statistical artifacts that multiples have that we need to be aware of. Then I'm going to analyze the multiple. I'm going to argue that embedded in every multiple are assumptions that you're trying to run away from in discounted cash flow valuations. Assumptions about cash flow, growth, and risk. And I'm going to use it to drive or come up with the variables that drive that multiple. And only then am I going to apply the multiple. Define, describe, analyze, apply. I'll tell you what my problem with pricing is. It's not that people price companies, but it's sloppy. They say a stock is cheap because the PE ratio is 15 and the average PE for the sector is 12. Come on. Or the average PE for the sector is 18. Come on, we can do better than that. This is not 1965 where we don't have access to the data. So I'm going to leave you the final page and we'll come back and kind of flesh out this page more fully. When I look at a multiple, I ask two questions. Is this multiple consistently defined? Second, is this multiple uniformly estimated? We start with the first question. Is this multiple consistently defined? Let me go back to that page I showed you describing a multiple. Here's a consistency rule. If your numerator is an equity value, your denominator has to be an equity value as well. If your numerator is a firm or an enterprise value, your denominator has to be a firm or an enterprise value as well. I know it's cruel and unusual punishment to hit you with this question so late in the class, but I'm going to throw a couple of multiples at you and you tell me whether they're consistently defined. Okay? PE ratio. What's in the numerator? Equity value, firm value, enterprise value. Okay, equity value, market price per share. And in the denominator, earnings per share. Equity value, firm value, or enterprise value?
Equity.
Equity. PE ratios are, thank God for small blessings, the most widely used multiple in the world is okay. Let's take EV to EBITDA. What's in the numerator? Market value of equity plus debt minus cash, at least in a rough sense, market value of your operating assets, right? What's in your denominator? EBITDA, which is a rough measure of operating cash flow. I don't love it, but it's a rough measure. EV to EBITDA is okay too. What about price to EBITDA?
No.
It's a horrific multiple. The analyst who invented this multiple should be tarred, feathered, and driven out of the fraternity if one exists. In fact, out of the 550 equity research report, 7 used price to EBITDA. One happened to be an old student of mine. He'd taken the valuation class 10 years earlier. I recognized his name, so I called him. And he said, who is this? And I said, remember that valuation class you took 10 years ago? He said, vaguely. I said, it shows. And I said, what are you doing dividing price by EBITDA? No. And he said, and I said, it's not consistent. He said, no, I'm being consistent. I said, what are you talking about? He said, I use price to EBITDA for all 15 companies in my sector. I said, that's a very strange definition of consistency. So I asked him, have you been noticing that companies with a lot of debt keep looking cheap to you? He said, yes, yes. And I said, have you ever stopped and thought about why that might be happening? Think about it. Why would using price to EBITDA lead you to find highly levered companies to be cheap? So it's in the numerator, market value of equity, right? So if you're a company that borrows money and buys back stock, your market value of equity is going to shrink, but your EBITDA is earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. before you feel too superior, though, if you ever use price to sales, you've been guilty of the same sin. People use price to sales all the time. You know why they get away with it? Because most of the companies they use it on, tech companies, for instance, don't have debt. But it's very sloppy. If you have EBITDA or revenue in the denominator, you have to have enterprise value in the numerator. It's a consistency test. In the next session, when we come back, I'm going to put subtests. And you're going to see very quickly why this becomes a big issue in pricing, is defining the multiple. The second test is it being estimated the same way for all 15 companies? You say, what's the big deal? What I'm asking is, earnings per share being estimated the same way? Are you following the same accounting standards? But more importantly, do you have the same degree of fidelity to those standards? Because you can be aggressive or conservative. So when we start next session, here's what we're going to do. We're going to take the consistency test to its logical limit by looking at three or four different multiples. And then we're going to look at the statistical characteristics of multiples and looking at what drives multiples. But by the end of this process, here's what I hope you will get out of it. I hope if your job requires you to price things, that you do a very good pricing. Because I think we can price things much better than we do right now. So this is not, is it value or price? You can do both. No? And it's a skill worth having, even if you're a true believer in value. So I'm done. Any final questions before we sign off? Sam asked, what's the most creative denominator I've ever seen? I think it was number of hits on a website. Their argument was, if you get a number of hits, so you're going to get a number of users, we've done revenues, all kinds of links along the way. But remember, in the late 90s, a lot of .com companies were valued based on website visitors. Now it's, if you have a software company, it might be downloads, even though you're charging nothing. So it's very interesting as to how people look for, you need a positive number in the denominator. You could divide by the number of cars in the parking lot. No. Yeah. Jessica asks, is the second note packet available to order from the bookstore? I don't think the bookstore is going to get back in business. They're always slow. And this has made them incredibly, almost like molasses. My suggestion is, I think you should download it. Now, I know it's a pain in the neck, but don't try to print it, because if ink is a scarce resource, you don't want to use it all up. But you can use Staples or somebody, it's probably cheaper than the bookstore anywhere. Yeah. But the second packet you can get on the link that John put up, but you can also get on the webcast page for the class, which is where everything gets parked anyway. Or, you know, it's, if you want the link directly, just send me an email and I'll send you the link directly, but it's available in multiple places. Okay, folks, that's it. Thank you very much, and I will see you next Monday. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.